Five News. From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nandi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Welcome to Tech Tuesday. There are the footprints we leave behind in the digital world even when we're not paying attention, the IP addresses from which we surf the web, the locations of the ATMs where we draw money, the smart trip swipes we use to board the subway. They all leave clues about who we are, where we're going, and what we're doing. But a few months ago, Wired magazine promised a writer $3,000 if he could unchain himself from his digital history and vanish for a month. They put a bounty on him, offering a $5,000 cash prize to the person who could track him down, setting off a coast-to-coast chase through a tangled web of IP addresses, fake social networking accounts, even a shell office in Las Vegas. And the experiment that started off in good fun revealed a host of lessons about life in the digital age and whether complete privacy is completely a thing of the past. Joining us to explore the philosophical implications of living in this hyper-connected universe is John Morris, General Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. That's a nonprofit public interest organization based in Washington that also studies the intersection of technology, the law, and public policy. John, good to see you again.
Good to see you again. Thank you.
Joining us from studios at NPR's New York Bureau is Nicholas Thompson. Nick is a senior editor at Wired Magazine. He's also author of the book The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitzer, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. Nick Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Nick, your magazine challenged the writer Evan Ratliff to completely discard his identity and start a new life. And you dared people to use digital clues to track him from an editorial perspective. Asked people to use digital clues to track him. What was the purpose of this exercise? What point were you trying to make?
In the September issue, Evan Ratliff, the man who went on the run, had written about how to create a new identity, how to disappear from your old life and to start a new one. And he wrote about people who had tried to do that, who had faked their deaths or things like that and tried to begin anew. After that story came out, we decided he should try it. We should explore these issues, see how hard it really is to do, see how hard it is to get away, see how hard it is to be tracked, see what it means when you give up all your privacy. So the way we structured the experiment was that he would go on the run for a month, but he wouldn't go live in a cabin in Montana. That would be too easy. He would try to create a new life of the sort he would want. So he would live in the sort of cities he would want to live in if he were starting again, and he would use the internet under a new name. I, meanwhile, would have access to all of his credit cards, his bank accounts, all of the digital information that a private investigator might have, and I would publish all of that on Twitter and on the Wired website. Readers would then take that information and try to find the real Evan Ratliff, take the clues from his old identity to find the new created identity. And it created this fantastic hunt, which I think taught us some very interesting things about several of these questions.
Well, John, that contest, the Vanish contest, was a game, pretty unique set of circumstances. But when you read the story, you pick up on a lot of everyday moments where all of us leave behind breadcrumbs in the digital world about who we are and what we're doing. What concerns you about living in a world where so much information about us is available online?
Well, you know, pretty much everything we do, sending email, checking on a website, going onto a Facebook page, all of that will leave bits of data, often IP addresses, internet protocol addresses that really show, in many cases, where we're located. That's a fact of life. It's something that anyone who's online needs to realize and appreciate. So frankly, I mean, what concerns me is one, that people don't appreciate how many breadcrumbs and bits of data they leave behind. And two, increasingly they have less and less ability to control that. I mean, there are technologies out there that, you know, we would like to see implemented that give more control to users, but those aren't really, you know, carrying the day right now.
If you'd like to join this Tech Tuesday conversation about going off the grid, so to speak, Call us at 800-433-8850. What do you think it would take to disappear and assume a different identity in the digital age, aside from simply going to live in a cabin in Montana? 800-433-8850. Or you can go to facebook.com/Kojo Show, ask a question or make a comment there, or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Nick, a lot of people like to interact on the web because they can be whoever they want to be there. They can assume a different identity, a different persona in a virtual world like Second Life, or in a video game world like World of Warcraft. But Evan Ratliff tried to create an alternative identity in the real world. What were some of the immediate challenges he ran into?
Well, the first thing is he had to be able to use his email without people being able to track it. That was part of the deal, that he would log into his email account. And so I, as the equivalent of the private investigator, would have what are called the IP addresses, which are the addresses of the computer he had used. So he had to disguise that. So what he did is he used software called Tor, which was initially designed to help protect Chinese dissidents, which makes it appear as though you're surfing from Germany or Zimbabwe, even if you're in Las Vegas. And then secondly, he set up a fake office, and he would essentially use his internet connection to connect through computers in that fake office, so that even if people broke the Tor and even if they figured out the computer that he had used to access certain websites, it would only take him as far as the fake office. So he had two very hard-to-break levels of security. So that was one of the first challenges that he had.
How much did you know about his plans for where he was headed before he started the game?
Nothing. And I didn't know where he was during the hunt. We had a very interesting way of communicating. He needed to be able to talk to me about how the hunt was going, and I needed to be able to talk to him about certain things, but we couldn't email each other, because then if people knew that we were emailing each other, there'd be a huge incentive for them to crack my email, which a lot of people were trying to do, but we didn't want to make it even more enticing. The way Evan and I communicated is that we created a public blog that anybody could have seen through Google's Blogspot. He would post something, and then I would delete it, and then I would post something, and then he would delete it, and then he would post something. So nobody could see the chain, and nobody knew it was there. We were essentially hiding in plain sight.
Well, we should know that Evan Ratliff did begin the game by using Tor controls. For those of you who are unfamiliar with what that is, it masked the locations of the IP addresses, as Nick was saying. It's free software that routes the IP addresses to make them look like they're from somewhere else. Evan configured them so that he could be tracked to an office in Las Vegas where he had set up computers, but apparently he got a little lazy and overconfident. Did he not, Nick?
Well, so at the end, it's very slow. If you use Tor and you connect through foreign offices far away from you, it's going to be very slow to access the web. So Evan, at the end, he's got about a week to go. He had to last 30 days and he'd win the money, and he made it, say, 23, 24 days. He started to get a little bit lazy. And so what he did is, when he was on Facebook, he wouldn't use Tor. And he thought that was okay for two reasons. First of all, he didn't think anybody knew the name of his fake new Facebook account. So he thought that was fine. And secondly, he thought Facebook is a private company. Nobody can track your IP addresses if you're just on Facebook looking at other posts on Facebook. But what he didn't realize is that one very smart computer coder had figured out his fake Facebook identity. And then not only that, but had written code on a page in Facebook that could track your IP address. So the guy, the smart coder, this guy named Jeff Reifman in Seattle, essentially set up a honeypot and put up something on Twitter that said, "Hey, I've got new information about Evan Ratliff." He knew that Evan Ratliff, under his new fake identity, would go to that page. And then on that page was the honeypot. So he tracked the IP address of Evan Ratliff, who had gotten lazy. Then he knew that Evan was in New Orleans. And from there, it was getting boots on the ground and finding him.
We'll talk about that in a second. But his first fake name was James Donald Getz, which was not only a nod to a character in The Great Gatsby, but it was also very effective in confusing people who tried to Google him, correct?
Right, because even if somebody found out that the name was James Gatz, Gatsby's original name in the story, you Google that and you're not going to find anything useful. You're going to find all sorts of people talking about Fitzgerald. So it was a very smart way of having to hide.
We're talking on Tech Tuesday with Nick Thompson. He is a senior editor at Wired Magazine. and John Morris, General Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. We're talking about going off the grid, how in this digital world we are so connected that it's difficult to become unconnected, and inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send us email to kojo@wamu.org. What concerns do you have about the digital information you leave behind in your routine daily activities? 800-433-8850. John, anonymity is part of the appeal of the web to a lot of people, but it's also what scares a lot of people about the online world. Try to take a law enforcement perspective for a second. How would you look at this challenge?
Well, I mean, certainly the online world creates a lot of new challenges for law enforcement because one can use things like the Tor software to really disguise where one's location. But it's also true that, as I think the investigators looking for Evan found, that there's a lot of information for law enforcement out there. So law enforcement has the ability to go to an internet service provider and say, who has this IP address? And go to service providers like Facebook or YouTube or whatever and say, who posted this video or who posted this this picture? So law enforcement has challenges, but they also have a lot of opportunities to find information online. So, I mean, it's really a mixed bag for law enforcement.
Nick, a lot of pretty smart people formed online communities as soon as this game started. You had people playing the game on Twitter and Facebook, sharing information with one another. What were your immediate impressions of the ways people were engaging online to participate in this manhunt?
Well, it's funny. When it started, we had no idea. We thought it might be a complete flop. I mean, maybe no one would be interested. But then people started to get interested, and it's one of those things where once a few people are interested, it makes it more interesting for the next person, and so on. And suddenly we had this huge hive of people. And it turned out, we didn't know this at the beginning, but it turned out that Twitter was absolutely the best way to hunt for Evan, because with Twitter, you can have a very fast conversation. Somebody puts up a post, somebody else can respond. The way it worked is everybody would put the symbol hashtag and then the word vanish in their posts, and then it would be that whatever they wrote would be visible to everybody else hunting for Evan. So we would have hundreds and hundreds of posts a day, people in rapid fire saying, I think he's here. I figured out his license plate number. You know, he only can eat gluten-free food. He has celiac disease. Here are the gluten-free restaurants in Santa Monica where I think he might be. Perhaps he's in San Diego. Wait, I've got this clue. And people shared clues very, very fast and had this. It was as though we were having a dinner table conversation with 600 people at their computers or 1,000 people looking up stuff and immediately just saying it, throwing it out there all night, all day, every day. So a lot of information was gathered and a lot of people thought through the complicated quest.
As an editor, a news person, what do you think this experiment says about the potential of crowdsourcing and cloud journalism?
I think it shows that if you have the right idea and people get engaged, it can work really well. Of course, we could have shown the opposite thing if things had gone slightly differently. I think with all crowdsourced ideas, at the very beginning, you either get set on a trajectory for success or a trajectory for failure. And a lot of whether you succeed or fail is, of course, on how you structure it and how you set it up and how you begin. But it's also just luck. We had very smart people in the beginning. We also had some people later on who tried to disrupt it. When you're having a Twitter
conversation. I was about to say, and that could be the problem if law enforcement tries to engage in the use of this technology by having citizens get involved. Because for me, one of the more fascinating things about this was, you're just about to talk about it, the counter group that was formed with people conspiring to keep him hidden.
Right. So there was a group that thought, oh, this is a fun game. Let's try to mess with them. And so they would post false clues and false information. And then there was this paranoia because everybody thought that Evan had created fake Twitter accounts and was following and was posting information. So everybody thought, wait a second. Is Dan Teller a mole? You know, is Ancestral Manor a mole? Can we really trust NX Thompson? And so they developed a system to make clear. We had one of the rules of the game. You know, there were five or six rules. One rule was that Evan was not allowed to lie to me. And so he could lie to everybody else, but he couldn't lie to me. So what happened was the Twitter community would make everybody who was suspected of being Evan or a rat send a public message to me saying they were not Evan. And if they did that, then clearly they weren't Evan because Evan's not allowed to lie to me. So there was this sort of this out, which allowed them to not be too completely paranoid. And, you know, law enforcement doesn't have that written into the rules.
We're going to go to the telephones now, starting with Laverne in Washington, D.C. Laverne, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. It's one thing when people are able to play games with this because they're tech savvy. But for those of us who are not and who choose to maintain their privacy, it is alarming and frightening to know that you can Google your name on the internet and see your address, an arrow pointing to your house, when you bought your house, how much you paid for your house, who your neighbors are, your phone number, even if it's unlisted, and anyone has access to this, even if someone is stalking you. Your death record is private information. Your living record is not. I cannot access anyone's death record, but someone can access my living record. They know where I live, and it's a shame that your privacy has now become a commodity for someone. Anyone can now make money off of people's privacy. And I would like to know, how do we go about limiting this? How do we go about controlling this? And what has happened to privacy? Why should my name, my address, my private information, everything be accessible to just about anyone?
That's why we have John Morris here. He's general counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. That's a nonprofit public interest organization that studies the intersection of technology, the law, and public policy. It also raises Laverne's question, does for me, John. We think of some of our information as private when it is, in fact, public.
Yeah, Laverne is absolutely right that just a phenomenal amount of information is available, ranging from your house purchases to
which is not private.
Right, which is a matter of public record. So Laverne's question is, you know, what can we do about it? Well, one thing we can do is we can urge Congress to pass baseline privacy legislation. This country lacks any across-the-board rules that govern private information. We have very specific silos of information that's protected, like health information has special protection, and peculiarly enough, video rental records have special protection. But general information about consumers, about users, about citizens is not protected. And so there is a growing consensus up on, certainly within the tech community, within the public interest community, and increasingly on Capitol Hill, that we need a baseline privacy law in this country.
Thank you very much for your call, Laverne. We're going to take a short break, but you too can call us, 800-433-8850. Dory's not going anyplace. You can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org. You can send a tweet at Kojo Show. What information are you willing to share with the rest of the web, whether it's on Facebook or on a personal blog? Kojo@wamu.org is our email address, or you can go to facebook.com/Kojo Show and communicate with us there. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Tune in for more true stories told live, no scripts, no second takes, next time on the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Leah Tao.
And I'm Catherine Burns. Audiences have lined up for years to hear Moth stories told live. Now you can listen from your couch or your car.
Listen to old-fashioned storytelling about modern life.
Stories for grown-ups, live on stage.
Next time on the Moth Radio Hour.
That's 3 hours of The Moth, this Friday night from 8 to 11 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy and the German Information Center, presenting Germany.info, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall in a spirit of gratitude to the American people. More at Germany.info. From Chevy Chase Bank, a division of Capital One N.A., presenting small business checking. Information and details available at branch locations. More at 877-987-4BIZ or at ChevyChaseBank.com, member FDIC.
WAMU 88.5 and National Geographic Live are giving away tickets to a lecture with photographer Martin Scholler, Thursday, December 3rd at 7:30 p.m. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar. Areas of drizzle this afternoon, temperatures in the low 50s, and overnight we'll see readings in the mid-40s. Now let's return to the conversation on the Kojo Namdi Show.
We're talking about Going off the grid on this Tech Tuesday conversation with John Morris, General Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology, and Nicholas, or Nick Thompson, Senior Editor at Wired Magazine. He's also author of the book The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitzer, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York. John Morris is in our Washington studio with us. We're inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Here's an email we got from James. Was Evan using a smartphone or a phone where you can download third-party applications? I have an iPhone, and I'm a little paranoid about downloading these cool applications all my friends have. It would be nice to have a little program on my phone to show me where to get sushi if I'm ever traveling to Skokie, Illinois. But if I download them, am I opening up my phone to the people who designed these programs? I don't want Mr. Sushi Programmer looking at my address book. Nick Thompson?
I can answer the question about Evan. He didn't use a smartphone. He used prepaid cell phones. And so he didn't even want a phone where he would have a credit card tied to it where the company would know where he was. He would just give $20, get a phone, make a certain number of calls, throw the phone away, buy another phone, $20. They're very hard to track. It's much easier to get away from that. I don't know if you have a smartphone how much information the app developers have. I highly doubt that they have information on who's in your address book, but they probably have a lot of information about how you use it. Mm-hmm. And they will certainly know if you go and you use it to buy sushi in Illinois, they might use it to give you an ad for a sushi restaurant the next time you're in Idaho.
Yes, the cookies everywhere. John, there's a passage in this story where Evan Ratliff says that if you're trying to disappear, a Greyhound bus station is just about the best place you can do it. I have said for years, I think the local police department has a permanent officer stationed every Greyhound station in the country, but that's another story. In the next couple of days, a lot of us are going to interact with airport security, walk through detectors, take off our shoes. How would you assess the effectiveness of this kind of security in our society?
Well, I mean, a lot of the security that we see at airports, frankly, is a little bit of security theater. In other words, it's kind of for show. The water bottle situation at airports is, right now, airlines are already guarded against the kind of assault that we saw on 9/11, and so we're kind of closing the door after the barn, closing the barn door after the horse is out of the barn, and so lots of the security that we go through, security experts will tell you, really is not paying off strong dividends.
And before we go to our phones again, Nick Thompson, we have to finish the story for those of our listeners who are not aware of how the story ends, because I found it fascinating that despite the fact that one individual had done all of this work, it ended up being the owner of a pizza parlor in New Orleans who actually pinned Evan down.
Well, let me tell a quick story before we get to the end stage, which is about 20 days in. Evan decided to fly. He really wanted to see a soccer game. And when you fly, you have to use your real name. So he paid, he went to the airport, bought his ticket, and assumed that nobody would be able to track him on the airline in the amount of time it took him to get to his destination. But it turned out that enough people were following him that on one flight to Atlanta, a worker at Delta, saw the list of Evan Ratliff, knew the name, sent it to a friend. The friend put it out, sent me an email. And so I got the email at about 8:20, and it said, Evan's on a plane to Atlanta. It lands at 8:25. And so I posted it on Twitter. Evan Ratliff will be in the Atlanta airport in 5 minutes. Evan actually lands a few minutes early. He gets off the plane. He boots up his computer. He sees that message. So he starts to just get out of there as fast as he can. Meanwhile, hunters converge on the airport. And it turned out, we learned later, that Evan decided to go out through the train in the Atlanta airport. And there was a hunter who went onto the train, probably the train Evan was on, and went through looking for him and, looking at every passenger. Is that Evan Ratliff? Is that Evan Ratliff? Is that Evan Ratliff? So there's a very close call based on someone at Delta Airlines giving out the information that Evan Ratliff was going to land in Atlanta. But the end stage. So this guy, Jeff Reifman, gets Evan's IP address through this clever Facebook coding, finds out that Evan's in New Orleans. Meanwhile, he's also found that Evan's new character, James Gatz, has a Twitter account. He wants to follow it. On Twitter, the way Evan had set up his account, you could only see what he was posting if Evan had accepted you as a follower. And so this guy needed to somehow get Evan to accept him as a follower. So what he did is he pretended to be a
Here
webcam
comes the social
girl.
Manipulation. Yes.
So he ended up, you know, sort of pretending to be a spamming, you know, girl with a video camera sending pictures so that Evan wouldn't think it was actually a hunter. He would think it was just a spammer. So lined up as a spammer to follow Evan, then was able to get Evan's posts. From that, was able to see that Evan had followed a pizza place in New Orleans called Naked Pizza. He assumed Evan was following it on Twitter.
Because Evan had to have gluten-free pizza, right?
Because Evan has celiac disease, so he had to have gluten-free pizza. So this coder in Seattle calls up Naked Pizza and says, "Hey, guys, I think Evan's going to come see you." The guys at Naked Pizza say, "This is awesome." So they get pictures of Evan to all of their delivery men, and they're fully prepared. Meanwhile, since there only was a week to go, at Wired, we decided to sort of up the stakes. And we had developed this crazy thing where if you solve the day's New York Times, we were given all the New York Times crossword puzzles for the week in advance. And we set up this strange thing whereby if you solved the puzzle, you could then use a key that we provided. And if you did that, you could figure out some strange thing that Evan had to do that day. And the deal with Evan was that for every one of those strange things that you derive from solving the New York Times crossword puzzle, he would get an extra $400. So he had sort of a risk-benefit analysis, but he thought nobody was onto him and he thought it was fine. So that day, we embedded in the Times crossword puzzle that Evan had to go to a book reading, which is a relatively innocuous thing. And so he thought, that's fine. Nobody knows I'm in New Orleans, so I'll go to a book reading. So he goes to a book reading. The people at the pizza parlor, meanwhile, know that that is Evan's challenge for the day. So they're pizza guys at the book readings throughout New Orleans. Evan gets off a bicycle.
I can't
get
over
that. He's got a shaved head. He's in disguise.
Goes to the book reading, yeah.
And they get him. They get him coming off his bicycle, heading into the book reading. And they find him. And, you know, he had a few days to go, and he was just crushed as he lost all that money.
Owner of the pizza parlor said, "Is your last name Fluke?"
Yeah, so that was – Evan and I had a deal. We had to – right, how do you determine whether he's been caught? What is a fair way to do it? So the deal was somebody would have to say the word Fluke to Evan. Evan would respond with the word Yankton 2, which is a special word between me and Evan. And then the person who said it would have to email me and say, "I saw Evan, and he said the word Yankton 2. Because a whole lot of people were scamming me, saying, "Hey, I saw Evan." Well, okay, what did he say to you? Well, I don't know. So I remember vividly getting off the train. You know, this game has been going on for a month. My wife is obsessed by it. It's so much fun. It's taken up all this time on Twitter all day. And I get this message as I get off the subway, and it says, "We found him, Yankton 2. I thought, wow. Oh, no, it's over.
Bookstore.
But I was also relieved and excited. He could not have been caught in a more interesting, technological, fascinating way. It was great.
Now on to the telephones again. Here's Peter in Washington. Peter, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. I'm on Facebook and have a couple friends who work for charities who started sending around this app that Chase Bank is doing, Chase Community Giving. Says, you know, go vote for my charity. I can get a lot of money. And when you go into the little rules from the Chase app, it basically says Chase can take all your information, buy it, sell it, use it however they want, you know, for the rest of your life. And I wonder, is that some sort of standard boilerplate? Should I be willing to give all that to Chase in order to go vote for my friend's charity or not?
Well, you know, John Morris, a lot of people who use Facebook also use third-party applications on that platform like Peter did. And when they use them, they give those third-party developers access to their information. What concerns do you have about this boom of third-party applications?
Well, not only does the third-party developer get access to the person who used the app's information, but the developer gets access to the friends of the person who used the app. And so if my friend goes and uses an app, the app developer may well, depending on the friend's settings, get information about me. And so, I mean, Facebook applications are certainly an area where people should be concerned about privacy. One really, I mean, the applications were, I believe, used in the Evan Ratliff hunt. To someone created a Facebook application that then reported information back to the developer, and the idea was that Evan Ratliff would go use this Facebook app and information would leak back to the developer. So certainly the caller is quite right to be concerned about information leaking through Facebook apps.
And Nick Thompson, Facebook Director of Public Policy, Tim Sparapani joined us earlier this summer on the broadcast. We asked him about how Facebook protects the mountain of personal information that it's sitting on, he insisted that people who use Facebook have what he called granular control over the information that they share with the rest of the people on the network. How do you see it?
Well, they do have granular control if you go into a complicated preference menu and know what to check and what to uncheck. If you don't do that, I mean, he probably went on this summer because Facebook rewrote their terms of service where they would control all your information even if you quit Facebook or died.
Right.
And so they had to backpedal from that horrible PR move. Yes, Facebook does allow you to protect your information, but only if you know how to manage Facebook. And I would bet that they have data, they have lots of data on their users, showing that almost nobody knows how to do that. But I want to say one thing on privacy that we learned from this story, which I think is pretty interesting and informative, which is Evan gave up everything. He gave up much more in privacy than most people give up. And people hunted down everything about him. They knew everything about, you know, everything he did in college. They knew every place he had had his car repaired. They knew everything about all of his restaurants. They posted a PDF of the deed of his apartment with his signature. You know, I had his bank account information. We knew everything he'd bought with his credit cards. He gave up all of the stuff, and he had thousands of people pouring through it. You could not give up more privacy. And yet, the hunt's over 2 months later, and Evan's totally fine. His life hasn't changed. Nothing has gone wrong. You know, it continues apace. Forever, you know, for the rest of his life, when you Google Evan Ratliff, you'll find all this crazy stuff about the hunt. But it's gone back to normal. I remember when he wrote the story that appears on the cover of this month's Wired, in the first draft, we had a paragraph about, you know, isn't it crazy all that people learned, and isn't that terrible for privacy? And then we started to talk about it and said, well, you know, that's true. It is amazing the amount of information they found on him. But what's also true is how little it means to Evan Ratliff now. He's fine.
You know, nope. Although
nobody's stolen his identity.
Nobody's stolen his identity. Nobody's manipulated his accounts. Nobody's done anything strange to his apartment. Nobody's, you know, created a fake Evan Ratliff and run across the country and done weird things.
You know, the cynics in our audience are saying, at least not yet, John Moore.
At least not yet. That is absolutely true.
Right. Certainly one answer to that is not yet. But the other answer is that Nick is absolutely right, that, you know, lots of privacy violations may not lead to a problem, but there are enough that do lead to significant problems that it's still worth trying to protect privacy. In other words, just because some people do just fine putting their entire lives onto Facebook doesn't mean that there are still not concerns about access to information. So, I mean, it's really, you know, and at the end of the day, you know, Evan made a choice to go into this game to, you know, knowing that his whole life would be turned upside down. And really, the goal is that people should be able to make choices about how much information they reveal, how much information they don't reveal. And on Facebook does have actually fairly robust privacy controls. But as Nick noted, they're really a little bit hard to get to and not very clear, especially as it relates to apps.
How do you see it? You can call us at 800-433-8850. How do you see our digital histories affecting how we live and how we interact in the future? You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show or shoot us an email to kojo@wamu.org. Peter, thank you for your call. You talked about what people are prepared to do willingly, John. Some people are more than willing to post thousands of photos without any privacy restrictions, install every third-party app, join every user group. What do you think explains this willingness that some of us have to be so, I guess, loose with the personal information we share online?
You know, I honestly don't have a good explanation for it. It's certainly not my own personal approach is to be very, very aggressively protective of my own privacy. But as I think Laverne, you know, called earlier, I mean, I from my home, I actually have a blind trust owning my home, so I'm not on the real estate records. But still, as much as I have tried to protect my own privacy, one can still track down where I live if you really try. So I mean I have a different perspective. My daughter has a much broader, you know, view of what information should be able to be online.
Indeed, the optimist in me says, Nick Thompson, that maybe people like Evan said, look, the truth of the matter is I have nothing to hide.
Well, that is something that Evan thought. If Evan had a dark past, or it had felonies in his past, he would not have wanted to play this game or participate in this challenge. I think that John is very right, and we also need to remember about privacy that the corporations like Facebook and Google, desperately want as much information as they can get from us because they want to make money selling us ads. And the more they know about you, the home you live in, the kind of shoes you wear, what you watch for television, they think they'll be able to sell you better ads. And so in some ways, that's good. I can get targeted ads. You know, I buy running shoes, not ballet slippers. It would be nice if I have to see a shoe ad that it be for running shoes, not for ballet slippers. But the question is, how comfortable are we giving up all of that information? And there's going to be, you know, I don't want to call it a game or a contest, but there's going to be a real battle between companies that want everything to be open to everybody and then smart people like John who are going to help design laws that will protect us in certain ways. And it's going to be something very important to watch, to follow, and to pay attention to.
We have several callers on the line. Please stay on the line. We're going to take a short break. We will get back to your calls. If the lines are busy, send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet at Kojo Show. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, what's Thanksgiving weekend without a trip to the movies? We'll find out if your holiday plan should include a fantastic fox, a serious man, animated aliens, or a destructive deluge. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the German Embassy and the German Information Center, presenting Germany.info, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall in a spirit of gratitude to the American people. More at Germany.info. From Trader Joe's, a grocery store with seasonal features like maple roasted sweet potatoes, sausage and cornbread stuffing, and cranberry orange relish. New holiday items arrive weekly. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
Today on Tell Me More, the recession is forcing many young people to move back home. The Pew Research Center recently conducted a survey to find out more about the so-called boomerangers. Guest host Jennifer Ludden talks with Rich Morin, senior editor at Pew Research, about the great migration homeward and other ways that young people are altering their lives to survive the recession this afternoon at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
I'm Emma Lyons, assignment editor for WAMU News. The Virginia State Police now say they didn't issue a $1,000 ticket during an HOV crackdown, and deliberations continue in the Baltimore mayor's trial. We'll have the latest on both during All Things Considered on WAMU 88.5.
Now back to the Kojo Nandi Show,
where we're discussing our digital connections and how far they follow us. We're talking with John Morris, General Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology, which is a nonprofit public interest organization that studies the intersection of technology, the law, and public policy. It's based here in Washington. We're also talking with Nicholas Thompson, senior editor at Wired Magazine. He's also author of the book The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitzer, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York. Let's go to Rufus in Washington, D.C., who I think, Nick, has a crucial question for you. Rufus, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm not a particularly tech-savvy person, but I like things that have intrigue involved. Who's going to play Evan in the movie?
Have you decided that as yet, Nick? Have there been movie treatments submitted yet? Is that what Evan is now working on?
You know, what actually did almost happen was a reality show where whether you could reproduce this and whether you could do it again and do it on television, where you had, you know, you could have a camera with Evan and you could have images of him that were clues. And that's being discussed. But of course, you know, being men or women being on the run, creating new identities is a staple of Hollywood and of fiction and, you know, Mad Men, right? That's based on somebody creating his own new identity. That was part of what drew us to the story, is that it's such an important, it's something, creating new identities is so common in real life, in fiction, and in cinema, that we really wanted to try to understand how it works.
Thank you very much for your call, Rufus. On now to Bill in Burke, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, how you doing, Kojo?
I'm well.
I, like everybody else, I'm concerned about the basic privacy and availability of information readily on the Internet, particularly your address and all that other stuff. And I found some basic solutions that everybody could use that don't cost anything. First one is the phone company doesn't have to list your address in the phone book. They just list your city and the state with your initial and your last name. Doesn't cost a thing. If they do an internet search or a reverse phone search, it doesn't show your address because they get their stuff from the phone company.
Anything else?
Yeah. The other thing is have a post office box. I have a credit card that has a post office box address. I use that whenever I'm on the internet ordering something, and I only use the post office box when I sign up for things or do things on the internet. So some very basic security things to keep people from knowing where you live and all the rest of that.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much for those tips. You too can call us if you have tips at 800-433-8850 for how individuals might be able to retain as much of their privacy as they possibly can. You can also send us a tweet at Kojo. So it's a Tech Tuesday conversation about going off the grid. Here is Robert in Centerville, Virginia. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Kojo. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to point out y'all were talking about Facebook. I can tell you that, for example, in countries like Venezuela and Mexico, where a mode known as Kidnap Express is very prevalent, many people are targeted from the criminals visiting their Facebook pages, even if they have kept them pretty clear of what they think is personal information. There's been a number of cases reported where the kidnappers got an idea of the net worth of the individual they were kidnapping and how much to ask for. So it really pays to be very careful whatever you post on such social networking sites as that.
Which reminds us, of course, John Morris, that we always have to be aware of the social context in which we are using our Facebook pages. It's different if you happen to be sitting in Guadalajara, Mexico, than if you happen to be sitting here in Washington, D.C.
You're absolutely right. It's also different who's involved. If we're talking about a 22-year-old who's making reasonable judgments to reveal their location, that's one thing. But if we're talking about a 14 or 15-year-old who's using a web-enabled cell phone or other device that could leak out location, you know, there really could be child safety concerns. So, I mean, really the context, both the environment, the social environment, where in this country, thankfully, we don't have the kidnappings that one might have in some other countries. But also who's involved and who really is in control of the information, does make an important difference.
Which brings me to this, Nick Thompson, an incendiary tweet or a lewd photo posted on Facebook today could come back to haunt a job applicant 20 years from now. What do you think this new concept of our digital history spells for how we're going to interact and take care of our reputations in the future?
Well, we're going to have to figure out those rules because there are a lot of stories that come out of people who post things on Facebook and then have it come back to bite them. And I think you need to... People obviously need to think before they post about what the consequences would be if their boss saw this or if a future employer saw this. One point about privacy that connects back to the story is that the one time that Evan got really frustrated and scared was when people started to try to track down his family members. So they found out who he was. But he had signed up for this game. He was prepared for it. He knew. And he had told his family about it. But then people started to call or they, you know, his girlfriend was... It wasn't quite clear whether she was being stalked or people were trying to, you know, hack into her phone. And that was incredibly frustrating and frightening for him. Fortunately, we had a rule that allowed us to get around that. And the rule was that I would never lie to people. And so I told all the hunters that Evan wasn't going to stay with his family, wasn't going to talk to his family, and wasn't going to talk to his and wasn't going to see his girlfriend. So there was no point in following her to try to track Evan. But for people who try to disappear, that's often how they're caught, is going back and getting in touch with their family. And it's also one of the things about digital information. This is a point that John made earlier, is that when people, you know, people not only, when they have your information, not only can find you, they can also find people connected to you.
On now to Seth. There's another side to that coin, if you will, and I think Seth in Catonsville, Maryland, will bring it up. Seth, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, guys. I have a job, but it's not as good of a job as I would like to have, and I've been looking for a new job since before the recession started. And I got told by a couple of employers when I called up to follow back that they didn't want to hire me because they didn't know who I was because I wasn't using Facebook or MySpace, and they did a Google search, and some other people with my name came up, but I didn't, and they couldn't find me. And it feels kind of wrong to me, but it seems like you can't get a job even when employers are hiring if you don't have your information out there for them to see who you are.
So you don't blog, you don't Twitter,
I'm very protected about my information. I have a lot of, I guess, paranoia. But I worry about other people finding out who I am and using it for whatever.
Yeah, because if you do any of those things, have a Twitter account, if you blog, if you're on MySpace, if you're on Facebook, you're out there. But this is a fascinating other side to this coin, John Morrison. Well, that is, if you're not out there, employers say, well, we just don't know enough about you.
Frankly, this is the very first I've heard about this problem.
Same here.
And it's very worrying if that becomes prevalent. I mean, I suppose that the answer is that one can create an identity, but have it a fairly controlled identity. I mean, one could have a Facebook page, but perhaps not have a very clear picture of oneself. I'm not quite sure. I mean, this is a challenging concern that I've never heard before.
Nick Thompson, have you heard about this before?
I've never heard about it. And if I were an employer, I would think that if the person doesn't have a Facebook or Twitter or MySpace page, they probably don't waste a lot of time at work. It might be a good person to hire.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would think.
Maybe you're just looking at the wrong employer, Seth.
That may very well be.
Okay, but thank you very much for sharing that story with us. It gives us all something else to think about.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. On now to Kyle in Annapolis, Maryland. Kyle, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, how you doing? I just had a comment about questioning why people maybe give up their information so easily.
Yes.
A lot of times the value of a commodity is determined by how hard it is to get. So if information becomes publicly accessible, then the value of it sort of drops. And personally, with my information, I mean, I'm 27, and the way that I think about it is, if a criminal wants to get my information, they're going to get it, you know?
And so you might as well make it available to as many non-criminal types as possible.
Well, I think taking common sense steps to protect your information is good, but really going out of my way, it's just not worth my time.
So you're saying that you feel that going out of your way would be essentially paranoid?
I guess so. An economist might call it an opportunity cost, but it's not worth my time to worry about it. If people want to get it, they're going to get it.
Indeed, that's why I use the word paranoia, John Morris, because now that we live in this wired world, people think that making too many attempts to try to hide your communications is really a form of unnecessary paranoia.
Well, you know, frankly, I think Kyle has a valid point, that there really is a balance here that can be struck or should be struck in terms of, you know, what people should feel comfortable doing. I think people should feel comfortable going onto Facebook, onto, you know, any of the other social networks and online media sites. But they ought to have the ability to control it. So, one ought to be able to reveal some information to your family, some information to your family and friends, and then a more limited set of information to perhaps everybody. And so, I mean, really, you know, Facebook does have that ability for kind of granular control in many contexts, and some other websites offer that same ability. So, I mean, really, there is a balance that each person has to strike, and really what we should be striving for from a technical perspective is that they users have the choice, have the ability to control, to make the choice.
Well, you know, we're clearly moving to a world where the mobile devices we carry in our shirt pockets and backpacks all have geolocation capability. But a story in, an editorial, frankly, in yesterday's New York Times really struck me. It's about a story based here in Washington. The Federal Appeals Court in Washington heard arguments last week about whether police should have to get a warrant before putting a GPS device on a suspect's car. Police, of course, make the argument that this is really not much different to putting a tail on somebody, which we would normally do. On the other hand, police do have to get warrants and court orders in order to wiretap somebody's phone. Where does GPS fall in that pantheon, so to speak?
Well, my answer to that is that we may well it may be appropriate for us to have rules that apply to government and law enforcement that an individual may well decide to ignore for their own selves. I mean, there's a concern about abuse of governmental power. And so, you know, to guard against misuse of governmental power, you know, perhaps that we should have certain hurdles. And I do think that placing a GPS device on a vehicle does require and should require a high level of court approval before law enforcement is able to do that.
This is a more extensive discussion, Nick Thompson, because it has to do with wiretapping mandates for the Internet, mandatory retention of IP addresses data heading into the future. I suspect this is something that Congress will also be weighing in on. Care to comment, Nick?
Well, one thing that we can relate to from the story is that it's not just GPS devices that can be tracked. It's your phone that can be tracked. And so one of the first things that Evan did when he was going on the run is he took the battery out of his phone and switched phones. A phone that's got its battery in it is a phone that can be tracked through, you know, people know where the cell phone, from where your cell phone is contacting the towers, they can therefore, you know, get your location fairly good. So that's, you know, important for somebody to know if you're going on the run and starting a new identity or if you're trying to track someone down.
John Morris?
Well, and it's not only just a simple cell phone. Any web browser that's using one of the more modern web location-enabled browsers like Mozilla and I think Internet Explorer, certainly Safari, can use location-enabled web applications that, you know, can be tracked, you know, can provide location down to, you know, a very precise level through Wi-Fi access points. I mean, it's one way that the technology does it. So, I mean, really just surfing over to, you know, Pizza Hut to find out where the closest Pizza Hut is, Pizza Hut may well get my location through that interaction with the website.
What are you expecting on Capitol Hill? We only have about 30 seconds left.
Well, I think that there's strong interest in at least an online privacy bill. We would prefer a broader bill that doesn't apply just online, but there is very strong interest in an online privacy bill.
John Morris is general counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology that studies the intersection of technology, the law, and public policy. It's a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Nick Thompson is a senior editor at Wired Magazine. He's also author of the book The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitzer, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. Nicholas Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, it's an American tradition, but every family puts its own twist on Thanksgiving dinner, whether it's mandatory tofurkey, chicken chow mein, or something else. Then, ideas for keeping your friends and family off the couch after that meal, with events worth seeing and places worth exploring this holiday weekend. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5.